Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Joined today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Happy soupy morning.
Yeah, man, it's been wet.
A little wet out there, but you know, not as cold.
Yeah, well, you know what? We need we need the rain.
Half full. Yeah, that is just perpetually half full.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of half full, today we'll pivot back to talking a bit about the political context of the 89th legislature here in Texas and what is going on at the legislature. And in part, by going back and kind of looking a little more closely at the polling we did on legislative priorities, legislative policy, in December, you know, and we've talked about this a little bit, mm-hmm. but not really looked at it, you know, full on. When the post we did when we rolled out this poll, we kind of drilled down this legislative stuff and really focused on that. And you'll find that blog post at our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. For those of you that have not been to the website in a little bit, mm-hmm. we have soft launched a redesign, refactoring, rebuild, all of those things, I think, to some degree. Maybe least refactoring, I guess.
Yeah, actually.
You know, but a redesign and a relaunch with a new back end of our website, which, you know, as you go, and if we are still fine-tuning. You know, when I say soft launch, we didn't really do a big rollout because we're not building the airplane while we're flying, but you know,
no, we're building several airplanes while we're flying. Yeah, right.
We're still, you know, making sure all the fixtures are tightened and everything. Let's put it that way in the airplane.
We're throwing the duct tape back and forth to each other.
Right. We think the gear basically, you know, all the energy, you know, the equipment basically works and is safe. But
right.
Anyway, probably not a good day to use that extended airline metaphor. But nonetheless, be that as it may, this week we moved beyond the kind of from a distance perspective that the poll took in finding kind of leading indicators of the legislative agenda. And we're getting closer to more concrete indicators of what will be battling for pride of place on the agenda of Republican leaders. And more specifically, you know, we're seeing a few more of the opening bids, the obvious example of that being SB2, the voucher ESA school choice bill, which is moving through the Senate as we speak.
Right.
And, you know, among those leading indicators, other than just the legislature being back and people being more focused and sending more signals, in a big signal burst, Governor Greg Abbott will deliver his State of the State speech this Sunday. Mm-hmm. That'll be, you know, once again, in apparent close cooperation with Nexstar Media, as has been in the last couple of State of the State addresses during session, in which we've moved from the tradition / norm, terms we're throwing around a lot lately in state and especially national politics, of that speech being delivered before the legislature for the last three now, starting with the COVID year in 2021. The governor has chosen on, you know, locations that highlight business and entrepreneurship in Texas, basically, as the site for these speeches, not giving them to the legislature. So we've got that coming up. And in a familiar instance of institutional jockeying and institutional and individual jockeying mm-hmm. to shape the legislative agenda, we're recording Thursday morning. Yesterday, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick released the first round of his top 40 priority bills for the regular legislative session, a lot of content in there. Mm-hmm. And in thinking back, I believe Lieutenant Governor, that this pacing is fairly familiar. I believe Lieutenant Governor has kind of jumped a little in front of the State of the State address mm-hmm. for the last few sessions. You know, lots of meat on there for us to talk about it a little bit today and certainly moving forward.
One thing I think is really great about the way that you've laid this out, and I think one of the aspects of this data that's actually, you know, it's, in some ways I was a little bit probably reluctant, even if I didn't express it in December to be asking about the legislature. I mean, oftentimes we kind of take that poll and think it's a little bit quiet. Let's do some trend items we haven't done in a while. We certainly did some of that. But actually, you know, kind of looking at it now with a little bit of distance, what's nice is that, you know, we asked this in the context in which none of this was going on. So we it wasn't as though voters, primary voters, Republican voters, Democratic voters are hearing about the agendas of the lieutenant governor. They're not trying to understand, again, the jockeying if they're paying a lot of attention in terms of what the priorities are and then sort of putting that into their own sets of attitudes about what the priorities are. So in some ways, the way that I mean, I think I like to think about this is a relatively clean measure of the priorities in some sense, right? Because we're not at the point in which, again, these legislative leaders and statewide leaders are really trying to, you know, go out and say, this is the most important thing facing the state. Because honestly, for some number of people, if they just hear, well, I think the governor said this is the most important issue, basically, that's going to push people. Now, that doesn't make that, you know, a non-attitude. It just makes it a little bit less deep. Whereas by going in December, outside of all the noise, this gives us a sense of what is the context in which this stuff is being received.
Yeah, it's a little, yeah, that's exactly right, I think. And you know, we talked through it at the time. And while, yeah, I think, you know, we both had a little bit of reluctance about jumping the gun, I think we did arrive at the right place on all this for all the reasons you're talking about. It's a, you know, contaminated is the wrong word, but it's, you know, it's a little less shaped by powerful signaling. I used the term signaling earlier, and that's not to say there wasn't signaling going on inside the Capitol circles or the, you know, professional political circles, but it wasn't very public in December. And even had it been, people are not paying attention. They're paying attention to other stuff. So we got an interesting measure.
One thing that, you know, we'll probably come back to throughout this session, and it's worth just setting up right now, is when we ask people how much attention they're actually paying to the legislature during the legislative session, the share of Texans who say they're paying a lot of attention usually increases over the course of the session, but from about like 12% to about 18%.
Right. You know, if we hit 20, it's like, wow, people.
Something
really
must have happened.
And to be fair, these are the people that say they're paying close attention.
These are people
that
say a lot of attention. So people are paying some attention. But the point is, you know, for those who are listening to this, you're in the very narrow band of Texans.
And, you know, and we've mentioned, we should note, and I kind of flagged this little, you know, the unveiling of these priorities isn't all news per se, in quotes. Mm-hmm. You know, there have been a lot of early indicators, you know, within the community of what these priorities are going to be, one of which is the speed with which the Senate has already, you know, had committee hearings on the school choice bill. Happened earlier this week or maybe late last week, this week.
Mm. Yeah, maybe that's.
You know, and that has moved through the Education Committee. And it's, you know, it's an interesting point for institutionalists and insider, you know, people that follow this closely inside. That was a very aggressive move to hear the bill so soon.
Yeah.
And to basically anticipate, probably with some degree of communication coordination, it's a good bet, no matter whatever the degree of coordination, that some kind of a school choice bill or some kind of school choice as a topic will be an emergency item.
Right.
When the governor releases those in the next few days. And this, of course, enables the legislature to bypass constitutional provisions that limit the passage of bills in the first 60 days.
And I think what makes this familiar is what we've seen over the last number of cycles, especially around the lieutenant governor's priorities. You know, one of, I think, the standard strategies at this point is to pass a bill, pass a big bill, throw it over to the House, and then ask them, like, you know, when they're going to get on it.
Come on.
Why don't you just pass that one or whatever? And I think that's, you know, what you're seeing right now, right? I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about vouchers a lot at various points, but, you know, big bill, kind of Cadillac looking, you know, and the question then becomes, okay, what's actually going to happen here? And, you know, the House is over there like, hey, we're still signing committees.
Yeah. And I think there's a, you know, again, minor, you know, sort of, but interesting insidery note, you know, the lieutenant governor made a point of saying, here's the first handful of priorities. But we're reserving 40 slots for priority bills. Last year, he reserved 30 slots. I think, you know, the norm is a little bit more around 20.
I was going to say, before that, it was fewer, because I remember it being more in the neighborhood of 20.
Right. And so, you know, the expansion of 40 for those, you know, if you think back to where we were at the end of the election and the discussion we've had that's been going on publicly, including with reporters, is how aggressively conservative is this session going to be given Trump's victory, Republican successes with statewide elections in the 24 cycle, you know, the margin of victory for Trump, all of the indicators that this is what the voters want Republican rule, they're good with it. How aggressive were they going to be? Now, lieutenant governor is always going to be on the aggressive side of the norm.
Yeah.
Or the median.
It's where he lives. I mean, it's
fine. Yeah, that's his spot.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's worth noting that, you know, they're kind of going for it. And, you know, one might argue in the first 25 priorities that there were some things that seemed a little like holdovers from, you know, previous sessions. But that's not obviously his prerogative, but also understandable, not too odd. But there's a few things that do feel like, you know, we haven't heard a lot about, you know, drag queen story time since it was an issue during session politics in the run-up a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and we were talking about this in the
week. And that's just one example.
Yeah, and that's one example. There's a couple. And if you go and look at the list, you know, you'll find various examples that seem, you know, more or less obvious to you on that. And I think, you know, we were talking about on the way up, and we'll see how aggressively the lieutenant governor fights on these issues and how publicly he fights on some of them.
Right.
But it does speak to, I think, sort of two sort of things struck me right at the bat looking at that. And one is, of course, you know, without Democratic control, in the wake of a, you know, again, a pretty solid Republican victory, you know, there are actually fewer obvious enemies. And so it might be the case that we do need to go back to the well on some of this stuff,
right?
Because it's not as though the Democrats are in an active space at this point to combat. So essentially, fighting yesterday's battles that haven't been won, you kind of make some sense, I think, in
that. Well, and look, it's, yeah, I mean, it's utterly consistent with the critiques of the House leadership and the tone of the primary by saying, you guys aren't getting enough conservative stuff done.
Right. And that's the second point here. If you look at some of these and you can kind of say, you know, yeah, the House makeup has changed. So the way the House reacts to some of these things might change. But also the House has expressed some clear resistance to certain aspects of the things that he's put in that first 25. And if that doesn't shift, I mean, the way that I think it looks from people like us who look at this institution, it's like, well, that's a great way to make a distinction.
Right. Well, enough, and, you know, and I don't know how much
to keep that going.
And I'm sure you've seen this, but I, you know, there's also this interesting dynamic that is part of that, mm-hmm. I gave a talk to a community group from out of town, I guess that was late last week. You know, one of the things I was talking about with them was an aspect of the general sense of the dynamic we're talking about, that with a weakened, less agenda relevant Democratic Party, and mm-hmm. I want to say they're powerless because, you know, right after this House election, clearly there are points when Democrats are still weighing in and have a presence, but in terms of agenda development, not a lot. That the fights you see are more between Republicans, mm-hmm. factions in the Republican Party. And an interesting, I think, illustration of the point you're making, but also that's an interesting turn on where we are is, you know, we've seen state representative money introduce a bill on the House side, mm-hmm. essentially ratcheting up, you know, the punishment of women receiving abortions, trying to cut out medicated abortion. This particular bill seems to me a bit of a bank shot on that, but that's clearly the intent. And Lieutenant Governor Patrick coming out and saying,
"Yeah,
hey, this looks like it might be trying to penalize women, and we're not doing that."
Right.
So, you know, or I shouldn't say penalize, you know, prosecute women criminally, and that's, you know. We got to be careful about that.
Right. There's some lines.
So, you know, if ever there was a sign of like where this debate is, I mean, it's an interesting point and where.
Well, it's interesting.
You know, center of the debate is and where the action is.
Well, and it's funny. I mean, it's one of those things where it does remind you that, you know, the enemy of my enemy isn't always my friend.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's only so much, and I would say more so than that, you know, amongst, you know, politicians, there's only so much space and there's only so much oxygen in the room. And it's interesting to, you know, to that point, just because, you know, Patrick and sort of the farther right of the Republican caucus in the House might, you know, be allies on some things. It doesn't mean he's about to like cede over the messaging here or just kind of go in on every wish list item that could come up.
And just completely open it up for what everybody.
Right. And he's basically saying right there. Don't think so.
So we should put a pin on that for when we come back to the strictness results.
Right, for sure. Right?
So it's a good, all this is, a, you know, a long intro to saying it's a good opportunity for us to talk over and review the legislative agenda related poll results from the poll we did in December when there were a lot fewer signs to read, as we were saying earlier.
Yeah, we can take a look at what do voters expect.
But there was
here.
Plenty enough to put together, you know, a good battery or two. And I would say, you know, as a general comment, as we go through this, we're pretty happy with these results and that. We got a lot of variance. Mm-hmm. It all kind of makes sense. We learned some stuff, but it all, given the setting we were talking about, it was pretty helpful. So talk a little, Josh, about, you know, what we found in terms of top priorities. And these came from this open-ended item that we asked on the poll that asked directly what voters thought should be the legislature's top priority in 2025.
Right. And this was open-ended, so people could provide us with any possible answer. And not surprisingly, slightly more than one in five voters, 22%, said, you know, they should do something about immigration or the border. You know, obviously much higher among Republicans, 37%. So nearly four out of every 10 Republicans who we asked said legislature should focus on immigration or the border. After that, the economy and prices, cost of living, 16%. Public education came in after that at 8%. Again, for Republicans, immigration and the border clearly out front, followed by the economy and prices at 14%. For Democrats, it's much more the economy, 18%, and then public education at 11%. And I think that's important to note there that even that public education percentage is being slightly driven more by Democrats and independents than Republicans. So 6% of Republicans said public education should be the focus, as opposed to 8% of the overall public, 11% of Democrats, 11% of independents. So for Republicans, it is a somewhat familiar story, which is, you know, what can the legislature do on the immigration issue once again? Which
right.
is, you know, again, why not surprising to see a pretty initial, big initial focus. And even really from the governor outside of the legislature, right, in terms of, you know, in terms of cooperating with the Trump administration, mobilizing National Guard members. I mean, really, you are responding directly to electoral concerns right now.
Yeah. And you know, I guess two follow-ups on that. One, we kept an eye out and created a bucket for ESAs, voucher-related school choice related responses, mm-hmm. and it didn't really move the needle much, right?
Yeah, I mean, as kind of we've repeatedly found in polling where we try to get a fair measure about around the salience of vouchers, and we see, you know, is this something that people, I mean, what we can say this is, look, as a basic sense, and you look at the polling, and we'll talk about this a lot or throughout the session, you know, yeah, people generally are kind of pro more choices, you know, so the idea is if you're going to say, hey, should we give people...
When it comes to this, yes.
When it comes to this. Well, I said generally people are into more choices. And so here, I think you see that at the same time, it's not necessarily a high priority for a lot of people when you start to ask about, you know, other things. They say, well, you know, I'm much more concerned about the border. I'm much more concerned about the price of, you know, groceries and gas. And even when we get to the education space, it's like, well, yeah, but like the facilities are really old and like, you know, the teachers haven't gotten a raise. And so.
And kids are getting shot.
Kids are getting shot, school safety, right? And so there's a lot of other, I mean, I'd say this, you know, whether you want to, however you want to place it, there's a lot of competition, both generally, but even in the education space.
Right.
And so it's not surprising that, you know, you don't see a high share of voters and even a high share of Republicans, because for Republicans, there are just much, much bigger issues out there.
So then let's just, you know, I mean, yeah. I think we could, you know, I think we can kind of tie Run. This together as we go.
Yeah.
So let's move. So how about, and then another way we approach this was something also that we have a lot of trend on that we've done before. We did, you know, what, you know, I always think of as the Goldilocks construct mm-hmm. for a question on spending, asking, giving people 12 different policy areas, asking whether the respondents thought that the state was spending too much, too little, or about the right amount in each of these areas. And, you know, these are pretty interesting responses that map on to mm-hmm. the priority responses.
Yeah, that's right. So what we found was, you know, across the 12 different policy areas, there were only three areas in which a majority of voters said the state was spending too little. Two of those were healthcare related. So mental health services, 58%, and healthcare, 55%. And the next one was one that we know is very salient to Texas voters, electric infrastructure at 50%. Just below that majority was K-12 public education at 49%, and children in the state's care, 49%. Border security was at 45%. Well, water infrastructure, which is sort of a big kind of, I mean, it's a big issue for sure, but it's one of those where you can kind of see elites really trying to push this message out right now before the session that this is going to be a water session. But actually, voters have expressed a lot of concern about water and a lot of polling we've seen all over the state. 44% thought the state was spending too little on water infrastructure. Now, it's really easy to kind of see this and kind of think, well, this is a preference for higher spending. And I will say there is one thing I do want to bring together here, which is the two big areas are healthcare and children.
Yeah.
And so you see right there, there's definitely, you know, it's I don't want to say a consensus because that would be incorrect, but you could say there is definitely some kind of critical mass around, you know, sort of people in the state's care like that.
Yeah. I mean, I like the broad construct of the people's in the state, in this people in the state's care. But I think it's worth flagging. It's interesting because we've seen this, and we've seen this in some more, you know, consulting side,
mm-hmm.
elite level polling. how large healthcare looms out there.
Well, you know, if you go even in this poll, and I didn't put it up in these notes, but if you go back to the economic concern battery and we ask people, you know, what it is they're concerned about, you know, obviously prices, kind of the cost of daily life.
Kind of the price of everything.
I think it was 69% said they're very concerned about it. But I believe, and I'm pretty sure this is right, 68% were very concerned about the cost of healthcare.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where when we think about, you know, inflation and we think about all this stuff, yes, there's sort of this daily, you know, okay, now your groceries cost 10% more. Now eggs are $5.15 instead of $2.60 or whatever it is. But at the same time, one healthcare issue, and that's like people's savings are wiped out.
Yeah.
And so that's something that, again, when we talk about salience, it's important to sort of understand that, especially people who have any sort of chronic conditions, anybody who's has someone close to them who has any sort of chronic conditions or deals with healthcare, these costs just don't go away. And as people who do polling, you can't conduct a poll where there's not at least about 10% of the public who's like, healthcare is just a huge problem.
And I think, you know, I think we have to fold that in to some degree. I mean, at least partially, there's, you know, there's kind of a, there's an overlap, but it's more of a Venn diagram, right? That, you know, this is reinforced by the price anxiety, because I think, you know, there's all the cataclysmic kind of big things that you're talking to about that people are experiencing. But I think, you know, there's also a lot of data out there that, you know, copays are going up.
Yep.
Insurance costs are going up.
Right.
You know, the prescription drug market is, you know, the recipient of a lot of attention with the, you know, the prices of prescriptions, the prices of drugs and all that. And I think that's all converging in a way that I think, you know, and I kind of said this in a talk I gave to this group last weekend with a legislator in the room or a couple. You know, I think lawmakers ignore that at their peril. Now, I understand what the, you know, this is one of those areas where, you know, I don't want to be diplomatic here, at least to some degree. You know, there's all this concern that we've been seeing. As you say, it's, you know, it ebbs and flows, and it's kind of at a flow right now, you know, that we've seen in polling as long as we've both been doing this. But there's also this countervailing, you know, the interest group universe on the healthcare side is very large and very powerful. Yeah. And I think it has a somewhat paralyzing effect on, or at least, you know, at the very, I should, paralyzing is too strong a word. I don't be hyperbolic. But it's got a very moderating influence on how legislators approach these issues, I think.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's interesting you bring
that. And it's complicated, to be fair.
Well, you know, you bring that up, and there's, and I mean, this is sort of adjacent to it, but I'm going to link it in, which is, like, you know, you talked about health insurance, but it's also, like, you know, the cost of insuring anything. I mean, there's a lot of concern about home insurance costs, thinking about what's going on in California, but Texas is, you know, in a similar situation. Yeah. And what I would say is, you know, this is all a general space we call, you know, there's a little bit of a risk management problem going on right now. And you see that in a lot of different sectors. You can see it both in the business sector with their concern about healthcare costs, you know, in particular. You can see it sort of in the insurance and home building sector.
Yeah.
And to the extent that the government is or is not going to engage in that, I think you're right. You kind of ignore it at your peril, because to the extent that the, you know, the risk management becomes, you know, essentially, you know, triage.
Yeah.
Well, now you need a strong, effective government. And honestly, like, that's not the political dynamic that we're in right now.
Yeah. I think that's a fair statement. So, yeah. Keep going on some of the internals.
Yeah. So,
this.
I mean, but I don't want to overstate this, right? So while this may, you know, seem to indicate like a preference for some higher spending, you know, the partisan difference here are incredibly important, right? So a majority of Democrats feel that the state is spending too little on 8 of the different 12 policy areas. We don't need to go into all of them. But among Republicans, a majority said the state was spending too little in only one area, border security.
Wait.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I thought everybody already knows anyway.
Okay, wait for it, we listeners.
Border security. You knew it, right? But I think it's important to note that a plurality of Republicans still said the state was spending too little in 7 of the 12 policy areas, including border security. But it's not an overwhelming call for more spending by any means. I mean, even on electric infrastructure, which is sort of a, you know, it's kind of a perpetual hobby horse, you know, 30% of Republicans said the state was spending enough, compared to 45% who said the state was spending too little.
And we should note that, you know, there are, you know, the preliminary budgets that we saw, which is another set of leading indicators I should have mentioned earlier. The preliminary budgets at the House and the Senate have both put up, dedicating more money to, you know, energy and the energy fund, et cetera.
Right. So, you know, how do we take this? I mean, I think one sense is, you know, I think, I mean, one of the things that my takeaway and kind of thinking about this and getting ready is, you know, one of the things that we've asked less about less directly than we have in the past is sort of just a commitment to small government, like a commitment to essentially, you know, keeping government small, limited services. And we will come back to some of those questions. I've already, you know, got some of them in the next draft, you know, for the next poll. But I think, you know, what's interesting is that that stuff's still there, right? I mean, it's not as obvious, I think, as it used to be. But I think one of the things that's going to come forward is, you know, what do we think about that? I mean, I'll just sort of throw a couple thoughts out there. You can react a little bit. I mean, one is how much of this is sort of the changing kind of ideological underpinnings of Republican Party and conservatism writ large, as it becomes more, at least, if not a populist party, at least a party that is aware of populism and sort of the role that the government plays and kind of, you know, as old term, like bread and circus, you know, like, I don't know where that came from, right? But like throwing out, you know, again, people want stuff. I mean, that was one of the things I think about the government freeze this week that was like kind of a big deal, which is, you know, you got a bunch of legislators getting calls, and you know what? There's a bunch of Republican legislators getting calls because people get worried when they don't get the things they expect.
Right. Well, and I think the interesting, you know, and I think most of this happened, although not all of it.
Yeah.
Most of that happened probably behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, you know, it's hard for me not to imagine we could not find actual instances of, you know, Republican representatives, Republican governors, you know, calling contacts in Washington going, hey, you guys just turned the Medicaid money off.
Right. I mean, you know, you've been tracking this for a long time. I was telling my wife this, you know, Jim isn't really interested in this, but I mean, the share of Texas's budget that relies on these federal funds is pretty astronomical, because anything in Texas is astronomical, right?
Yeah. But I mean,
you can't just turn it off.
But, you know, the second federal income for Texas, federal funds are the second largest single source of revenue behind only the sales tax.
Right.
And we all know that we rely on the sales tax massively in the absence of an income tax in the state.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can't. You know, when you look at what the number was, and this was, I didn't, you know, I was looking at, you know, one of my favorite sites, the receipts
exactly.
at the comptroller site, you know, and looking at some of the, you know, the data from last year on this and looking at the trends, as you know, which I'm interested in. But, you know, one of the stories, I believe it was the Tribune coverage of the initial order that came out of the White House, or that came out of OMB to turn the spigot off on that money and then turn it back on. They wound up turning it back on pretty quickly. Was that, you know, one of the estimates of how much money was at risk there, you know, in the current budget was in the ballpark of high 80s, close to $90 billion, I think, which, you know, is getting, you know, more than a quarter and almost, you know, more than a quarter, but not quite of a third of what the overall biennial budget is. And, you know, that's a lot.
Yeah. You can't, well, thing, you can't just replace you know? It and you can't just cut it away. And that's the thing. I mean, my sort of, you know, go-to example is, you know, there's a lot of Republicans in West Virginia who rely on heating subsidies.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, whatever, pick it out, pick a policy, pick a group, whatever, you know, and it's so, I think that's one of those things you see. It's going to be one of the challenges going forward. It kind of dovetails with last week's podcast about, you know, trying to transform government is going to be painful.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to take on that pain. And what you could see right away is, you know, as much as, and I agree with you, I mean, there's a lot of behind the scenes discussions are going on. And as much as there is, you know, sort of this unflinching support, especially among Republican elected officials for whatever the president is going to do right now, you know, they were making a lot of calls.
There was some flinching going on.
There was a lot of flinching going on.
And, you know, people are afraid of Trump and afraid, you know, and I, you know, rational response that's been well cultivated.
Yeah.
and a strategy. But I think it's hard to imagine that there was not a lot of pushback on that. And that's part of why we saw the response we did. Yeah, I mean, look, so I think, you know, there's two things going on here. And I think, you know, you kind of touch on them both, and I don't want to be repetitive. But I mean, I think, you know, one of the things you said is like, you know, where is the Republican Party? Where is conservatism on spending in small government? And look, there's a long time, you know, academic research and political argument that says, yeah, look, people always talk a good fight about small government when they're talking about what government is doing for not them.
Right.
When you start talking about what you're doing for them and their direct interest, then all of a sudden, you know, the government is too big in other places.
Right.
You know, and that's that's always been, there's always been, you know, whether it's Bill Clinton and the era of big government is over and Al Gore and his task force that, you know, some people out there will remember to make government more efficiency. I mean, this isn't the first, you know, DOGE that's been attempted, and it's been attempted by Democrats. No matter what, there's always a sense of, you know, the struggle between some kind of principle and some kind of abstract idea of what the ideal size of government is and what, how that actually happens, which is just going to be inherently political, as we say about a lot of things. It's not, you know, unlike voting.
Yeah, I mean, what I've been saying, you know, again, what I've been saying to a lot of people in the last few days about this is, you know, it's not as, I mean, based on our polling, there aren't a lot of people who voted for Trump with the idea that he was going to go in and just totally dismantle the federal government.
Right.
And in certain sense, and those people were going to vote Republican regardless, 100% of the time, yeah, no matter what. And to the extent that, you know, Trump can claim a mandate, can say that, you know, he performed so well, whatever, that's really largely off the back of people who decided late and probably decide based on, like, I hope this guy improves the economy.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I think that is exactly right. And I think that, you know, cognitively, you know, the kind of cognitive science cliches here are really helpful because, mm-hmm, you know, there's this idea where you want to go, well, you know, people, like, you know, they want limited government. They don't want, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, people always want contradictory things.
Yeah.
And are more than willing and able and wired, you know, to continue to think of themselves as a small government person, but say, but, you know, you better not cut my Social Security.
Yeah, I hate PBS, but I love Daniel Tiger.
Yeah, you know, there you
my
go.
My kid loves it or whatever, right?
Yeah, so there's, you know, I mean, I don't want us to be naive. And I also want to, like, on this tax thing, you know, I know that there are people listening going, well, look, you know, yeah, you can be as fascinated as you want by all the money the federal government, right, gives Texas. They take more in income taxes. And I, you know, that argument is out there, does not,
yeah,
to my mind, have any bearing on the fact that the budget relies on huge amounts of federal spending. And were that federal spending to disappear, there would be, or even be cut in half.
Yeah.
There would, and should it happen, will be howls.
Well, and you know what's, I think, great, and just to bring it back to this data for a second, what we don't see in this data is any sort of sense by anybody that Texas is spending too much on almost anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's here. And I think what I would say is, you know, just to move this on to the next piece and just sort of think about, again, yeah, the Republican coalition. I mean, my actual full-on takeaway from this, just keeping it focused on Texas for a second, is this actually gives legislators a fair amount of flexibility and state leaders, because really all that the Republican electorate is calling for is keep that border security spending high. You know, make sure we know, it seems to be.
Keep the lights on.
Keep the lights on. Keep the border
warm.
Keep the, yeah,
or
keep
cool in the summer.
Yeah, keep the lights on. Keep the border security spending high. But after that, you know, they're not asking for massive shifts in what we see, you know, in terms of the distribution of funds. Like, we don't see that anywhere. So I,
right,
think that's kind of, now look, if the lights go off, if the water stops running, right, things can change dramatically very quickly. But I mean, there has to be something, like, I mean, what we've seen in the past, and I think this is really important here, and this is the difference between abortion on the one hand and electricity on the other. One of those impacted almost everybody in the state. One of them is relatively targeted in some ways, comparatively.
Yes. Now, to be fair, we realize that, you know, one could perceive that targeting is at a little more than half of the population. But
yes,
your point is well taken.
Right.
That's more of a caveat. But you do. That's a good transition. Let's talk about the, you know, let's finish up with the last battery then, which is when we asked about whether or not the state's laws should be made more strict, less strict, or left alone in some of the high-profile, historically active domains, you know, including gun laws, abortion laws, gambling laws, marijuana laws. And then the thing that is a little unlike the others, but which we couldn't leave out, and that is voting laws.
Right. You know, and here, once again, you know, you see some pretty mixed results. And I want to just say, you know, about our approach, I think, to this, because I think both of this is kind of here. And I, you know, I've been having some discussions with different people about this, you know, because as the legislature gets more active, you start to get what seem like more solid proposals. You know, you start to say, well, wait a minute, though. That's, you know, don't ask about, why are you asking about vouchers in general? Why don't you ask about the Senate's voucher bill? And the answer, you know, in our cases is sort of twofold. One is the fact that I think what we're trying not to do on this is message test other people's stuff that's already been message tested, right? There's a reason that things are described the way they are, because,
right,
there's a lot of work that goes into that. And additionally, it's going to change, right? I mean, we already said that, you know, the Senate voucher bill is a great example. That's a really strong negotiating position to begin negotiating with the House, assume the House gets something to them, it's probably not going to look that way. They're going to have a conference committee. We could spend the entire next poll testing provisions in the Senate voucher bill if we wanted to, and none of those provisions may actually carry through the final legislation that passes. So some of it is just about that. But the other thing is an approach, which is to say, I think we try to take one step back from the policy and try to get a little bit of a better sense of the general underlying attitudes, knowing A, that most people aren't paying that much attention to this, B, there is a lot of flexibility, and C, people generally don't, most people don't hold very, very strong policy views in terms of what the policy should actually look like, but they have a sense of like they want it to be tougher on X or easier on Y or less regulation for business or whatever.
Z should cost me less.
So that's or, you know, less, exactly. Yeah. And so at least at this point in the session, it doesn't mean that later in the session we're not going to go and look at specific, you know, ideas as best we can. But at this point, we really want to get a sense of, you know, should we go this way or should we go that way?
And, you know, I'm trying to think of a way to, the best way to put this, but you know, we want to both respect our respondents and by extension, the people of Texas, but also be realistic about the limits of what, how deep and how complex people's attitudes are about complex policy issues.
Right.
You know, one of the functions of representative government is to offload the complexity to the people that you elect. Now, one could argue about how well that works, but or how well it's working at the moment. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, I think it's part of our and, you know, and look, we, you know, I don't want to present this as just something we easily do. And, the, you know, but, you know, I mean, is calibrating at what point are we overtaxing the existing attitudes of our respondents?
Right.
You know, if I give them a and we've done this occasionally because we felt like we had to. But, you know, we try to avoid giving people the complete policy package of something very complicated because, I still think you kind of lose people and it makes it harder to interpret the results.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you want to spend more or less or about the same. You know, you think something should be more strict, less strict or left alone, you know, defines the universe people are in. And at and if we do have to go back later or down the going forward, if down the road, you know, we do find it appropriate, necessary to ask something in a more detailed, perhaps even, you know, multi-part way, which we try not to do, you know, we've at least got the parameters out there to interpret that can also be used and brought to bear to interpret those results.
Right. Yeah. No, exactly. You know, is your opposition to vouchers because it's too much, too little? Is it because it's giving $2,000 to the homeschool kids or because it's, you know, like, and that's not enough? You know, and you just don't know.
Or is it the religious, you know, I mean, you know, there's a bunch of different things that are lurking in there.
Right.
And if you're giving, you know, if you're, you know, particularly you take the proposal on the table right now.
Yeah.
If you are trying to get a sense of, you know, either how much the state ought to spend overall or, you know, what the spending levels should be for certain constituencies, you know, you're asking a lot of your respondent.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I should admit I'm going to admit something here.
Okay.
I'm going to be vulnerable.
Let's be vulnerable.
Okay. So I'm not from Texas. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me is, I know, I have two Texans. I live here. I love it. I got Texas shirts. I'm all about it, guys. Don't worry. But one of the things that struck me about moving here that's so funny is like there's this tendency to always tell you what things cost. You know, you're watching the local news. You're like, oh, they're putting new lampposts up on Lamar and it's going to cost X, you know, $100,000. And it's like, I don't, you know, I'm a smart guy. I follow a lot of stuff. Is that a lot of money? Is that what lamppost should cost?
Should a lamppost cost more or less?
I don't know.
Right.
But that's the sort of thing. I mean, at a certain point, you're like, you know, you kind of got to say to
yourself, $500 million or $1 billion going to buy me enough vouchers? I don't know.
Yeah, well, and then for me, the question that kind of comes out of that always is like, well, what's the Texas budget? Now, we are, you know, dorks and we have a pretty good sense of what that is. But I can tell you right now, most people have no idea what their city spends annually, what the state, what the county spends, what they're spending on healthcare, what the distribution. I mean, so this is why questions like this are probably at the right level, which is is like, hey, do you think we should be spending more on healthcare or less or the same? Do you think, you know, we should make the gun laws more or less strict? We're not telling you what. We're just trying to get a sense.
You know, and frankly, as soon as you get into large numbers, people aren't, you know, it doesn't, you know.
It means nothing.
It just doesn't mean anything.
Nobody knows what $1 billion is. I mean, just realistically.
So what did you really notice? What really stuck out to you in this battery?
So, yeah, I mean, this is a high profile area, a lot of mixed results. You know, only gun laws saw a majority of Texans asking for more restrictions, and only barely. 50%. So 50% of Texans said we should make the gun laws more strict. A plurality, 43%, said the state's abortion law should be made less strict, along with 41% who said the same about the state's marijuana laws. Now, obviously, neither of those positions are likely to hold the day. And if the lieutenant governor is to be believed, certainly not on marijuana. But here, like in most places, you know, the views of Republicans are the ones that are paramount because they're going to kind of give us an explanation about where the thrust is, right? And what you find is, you know, making the state's voting laws more strict or leaving them alone, 85% of Republicans, 49% would make them more strict out of that 85%. You know, 66% of Republicans would either leave the state's gun laws alone, 40%, or make them less strict even, 26%. So again, if you think there's going to be a bunch of big, you know, if you're wondering why aren't there going to be movement on red flag laws or raising the age to purchase, you know, a semi-automatic weapon like I talked about last time, well, because 2/3 of Republicans would rather either leave them alone or make them less strict.
Yeah, and yeah, you know, I just want to flag that less strict. And again, you know, people, you know, it's a quarter of Republicans and, you know, who want gun laws made less strict still. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at the internals on that, it's strong Republicans mm-hmm. and strong conservatives. You know, it tells you a lot about the political dynamic given the context in the state.
Right. You know, leaving the state's abortion laws alone or making them more strict, 68% of Republicans, 37% of Republicans, a plurality there, would make them more strict still. So that's why, you know, to the extent that there are, you know, bills being filed, there's still appetite out there, even though, again, a lot of the public discussion has been about the fact that maybe these laws need to be clarified. That's not where the majority opinion is in the majority party's voters. And then lastly, you know, again, the lieutenant governor's made clear that, you know, if anything, the marijuana is not getting decriminalized. And if anything, maybe more criminalized. 59% of Republicans would either make the laws more strict around marijuana, cannabis, 39%, or leave them alone, 20%. Right. So that gives you a pretty good sense of, you know, the fact of when, you know, I mean, I get a lot of calls like, well, wait a minute, you know, we see a majority of Texas voters say, you know, they basically don't agree with the state's abortion laws. Yeah, but got to dig in a little bit here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we saw Republican attitudes moving on that for a little bit, but I think that they've reset. I have to go back and look at the
There's been a bit of a reset. I mean, it's interesting. I mean,
you know, it's not a complete reset, I don't think, but it's, you know, it's rolled back a little bit from a period where it looked like, you know, I mean, you know, in the popular culture, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's become a talk show joke, you know, I mean, it's become a mainstream thing to refer to, you know, your gummies kicking in or, you know, going home. And we're not talking about kids and hippies. We're talking about grown-ups.
Yeah. Right. Suburban moms.
Yeah. And so, you know, but it is interesting to see the 39% more strict on the Republican side and see the degree to which the lieutenant governor is making some moves on this. And look, it's been an open semi-secret that, you know, at the peak a few years ago of probably support for both relaxing on the criminal justice side, criminal penalties, and more legalization and access, you know, consumer access to THC products, basically. You know, it was an open secret that the lieutenant governor was, you know, the barrier here.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things
that doesn't mean that every senator is like great with it, but the lieutenant governor has been very definite about saying this is, you know, not on my, essentially all but not on my watch.
Yeah, and it's part of a piece to say, you know, in the sense of, you know, bail reform means not letting more people out on bail. That's still there. So I mean, to the extent the whole sort of the sort of drug criminal justice system intersection, you know, has been an ongoing discussion. There's very little indication that the lieutenant governor is on board with that. But also, I mean, if you look again at the electorate and you look at the voters that he's responding to, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I just think it's important to say that because it's very often, I think people look at a place like Texas or they look at results and they say, well, this is just, you know, they throw around the word undemocratic or something. Well, I think you need to be a little bit more fair here in looking at these sorts of results a little bit more closely.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you would mention that, and you and I haven't talked about this, and you know, this is, should probably be an offline conversation, but I'll just flag it online.
Let's do it
for a sense of us, you know, whatever, you know, giving people a peek behind the curtain. You know, I have noticed, and I'm wondering if you have an uptick in reporters calling me with somebody where the framing that's floating around in there is, well, it seems to me your polling shows the public wants this and the legislature's not giving it to them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's, you know, look, that's a, you know, and it's a good, I mean, you know, journalists should be watching out for government responsiveness.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not arguing with that at all. But it just seemed like there's been a bit more of that to me. I've been noticing it more. And again, we're talking about cognitive habits, could be recency bias, could be a million things. But it seems to me that I'm hearing that a little bit more in the discussions as people are reaching out and letting me know like a story they're working on, and they're conveying how they're framing it.
Yeah, I wonder if, I totally agree with that. I mean, I feel like
you're experiencing
I'm experiencing that question. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of discussions that I'm having with people where I have to say, okay, before we talk about what you want to talk about, let me just sort of explain, you know, the role of the Republican primaries and kind of conditioning the Texas political agenda.
What is the institutional and political context for public opinion data?
Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, to some extent, you know, I'm wondering.
And I'm glad we need to do that, or we probably wouldn't have a job.
Yeah, no, I love it. I'm wondering if, you know, part of the reason that that's kind of taken place is because, you know, the primaries last time were so noisy, you know, here in Texas. And sort of, and I mean, I think for a lot of non-Texas based journalists trying to make sense of what was going on here, when you see, you know, a powerful governor going after incumbents within his own party, seemingly conservative incumbents, it sort of required kind of, I think, a lot of cognitive effort on a lot of people's parts to sort of try to unpack what's going on in a way that, just to be honest, like to write this out in a 750-word column or that, it's difficult. I mean, to sort of explain these kinds of things. So I want to say right now, it's not actually easy to do. And so I usually have to spend, you know, the first like 5-10 minutes of the call, but let's just talk about this for a second. Then then think of these are still the same questions you want to ask. But I wonder if the noisiness of that sort of distracted from, in some ways, you know, what are otherwise, you know, kind of just the normal, the normal politics of this.
Yeah, I'm writing a note here. The scribbling's probably getting picked up on the recording. Sorry,
it's maybe happening a little, for real.
But that's okay. Makes it real. I mean, you know. You know, a post on that might be a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? I want to ask you one more thing about this before we wind this up, because we're getting to that point. You know, there was some discussion among the polling team on including laws regulating online access to online pornography on this.
Yeah.
But, you know, it gave us some variance. I'm just wondering what you made of the results. We haven't really – we've talked about it briefly, but not much.
Yeah. I mean, I think it both showed what I thought it would show and didn't. I mean, in the sense that, you know, what you found was a similar pattern in terms of kind of the ideological expectations. You know, you saw Republicans expect, you know, wanting stricter laws around regulation of access to online pornography. And for those of you who don't know about this, there's a law passed by the legislature in the last session that essentially requires stricter age verification requirements and are currently required on sites that host adult content. I mean, that's not exact. I don't know if that's exact.
That's pretty close to what the law is.
You know, there might be some minor differences here. And ultimately what this has meant is that, you know, essentially a lot of the largest pornography websites on the internet have essentially shut down in Texas. And so, right.
Yeah, because there were significant penalties per violation, I think, that made it, you know, it was an economic club.
Right. And I think, you know, they would say, well, we don't really know how to do this. And I think the legislature would say, well, you better figure it out. But
and privacy advocates have privacy concerns because the verification required, I think, providing ID and things.
Yeah.
Like
I mean,
this,
it's right? I mean, look, you know, I mean, I think you don't need to be a social scientist who studies people to know that, you know, asking mostly men to provide their driver's license before looking at pornography probably going to drive down your audience a bit. So again,
decrease in traffic.
Little decrease in traffic. But so again, to the point, and I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but again, you know, Republicans reacted somewhat as you'd expect in the conservative sense. 58% said make them more strict. But look, Democrats too, 46% said make them more strict.
Yeah.
And that was the plurality position for Democrats. There was a gender gap. I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah.
But there was definitely, I think, about a 10 to 20
point. I was going to say gender, it was 10 to 15 points.
10 to
15,
yeah,
like
10
that.
To 20 points in there, you right. know, where men were, you know, kind
we just want to say we're modern people. We know women both enjoy and want to and have should, but there was a
but the distribution
gap.
Of the market is clearly different.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things. I mean, I think, you know, because we were just kind of curious just to see what kind, you know, how, what is the reaction to this going to look like? And ultimately, you know, it definitely kind of looked like what we wanted, but I think with the Texas
A little bit of a Texas twist. Yeah. And, you know, and the other thing I would clarify there is, like, there's a difference between Republicans and Democrats. It wasn't that big.
Yeah. No.
Right. I mean, a majority of Democrats or a majority of Republicans, you know, wanted more strict laws, but a pretty big plurality, almost half of Democrats, too. So,
yeah, you know. Exactly.
We were curious about I was curious about the gender gap, curious about the partisan gap and
age gaps. I mean, there's
there's interesting things lurking in here. Maybe lurking is the wrong word to use in this context.
There's
all kinds of, I'm going to indulge the worst of my dad humor here. I'm just going dad / high school / college adolescent humor.
Yeah,
I won't do that.
Please don't.
But, you know, it was an interesting thing in there that I think gave us, you know, the other thing I would just notice in this, given the amounts of money and probably employment, among people that are likely to listen to this on gambling, still no consensus, right? 30% wanted the laws more strict, 30% less strict, 20% left as they are now. And the highest don't knows in this. 14% saying they didn't have an opinion. Among Republicans, critically, 28 more strict, 30 less strict, 29 left as they are. And then Democrats.
Basically the same.
31 more strict. 31 less strict, 25 left as they are now. So if you're one of those people that's going like, how long can the lobbying boom in gambling last? I would say a while.
Yeah, actually, you know, one of the things, having seen those commercials up, recently, I'm sure you have too.
Yeah.
Let the voters decide, and stuff. I mean, I think that's actually really wise because when you look at something like this, I mean, one of the things is someone who studies public opinion, when you see a result and the responses are essentially evenly distributed across the options, you have to ask yourself how much of that is real opinion, how much of that is kind of guessing.
Yeah.
Right? Because ultimately there are three substantive options and you have about a third of people each choosing them. You have to say to yourself, now look, that does mean that there is no consensus, but it also kind of tells you there's probably some movement available in there.
Right. Well, and no less than the lieutenant governor, made a very similar argument about this.
Yeah.
In an interview, late last year that I've referenced a few times, in which, he was playing his hand diplomatically soft, but, I think left not a lot of doubt about what he thinks in terms of him saying, I know that polling shows that there's, a lot of people that are interested in this and, a lot of people are making an effort to, to persuade the public. But I do think that, I'm paraphrasing, this proposal to really start moving, a proposal to expand gambling, start moving, we would start hearing from a lot of people that are not in support of this, like in the faith community, et cetera, saying, do not take this for where it stands now.
Yeah. Go convince the hardest people to convince and then come back and talk to them.
Right. Right. So with that, I think, this is a pretty good, introduction to all this. Hope you got that the listeners have found this review of the polling in a little more detail with a little bit updating the current events useful. We'll keep an eye on this and, of course, do more polling on this. If you're listening to this on a podcast platform, if you go to our new improved website on the very front page, you will see a link to the podcast that will then link to a lot of the results we've talked about. So I would urge you to do that and poke around at the new website. Beyond that, thanks to Josh for being here on a rainy day. Thanks to our production staff here in the audio studio in Liberal Arts Instructional Technology Services at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks to you for listening. Remember all this and more at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And we will be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.